Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to share my story and talk a little bit more about IFFGD.
Excellent. So first off, right out of the gateway, can you explain to the audience exactly what IBS, or irritable bowel, is, and describe some of the possible symptoms that can be accompanied with that?
Sure. Irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS, is a collection of gastrointestinal symptoms, which could include abdominal pain and an altered bowel habit, as they say in sort of medical terms. What that means is that you have pain in your abdomen area that is associated with a bowel movement, and that can be having diarrhea or having constipation. And generally, that pain is relieved by the bowel movement, although there are some patients who say that it might intensify or get worse immediately following a bowel movement. Traditionally, that pain is relieved by the bowel movement, and then you tend to feel exhausted immediately following, but then the pain gets better until the next episode.
Now, I understand, too, that there are various forms of irritable bowel.
Yes, there are. So with irritable bowel syndrome, they technically have what they call four different categories for irritable bowel. There is irritable bowel syndrome with constipation predominance, and that's when at least 25% of your bowel movements are hard stools. And then we have irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea, where 25% or more of your bowel movements are watery or loose stools. You can have what's called mixed irritable bowel syndrome, mixed, which means that you can go sort of both ways. So sometimes you might have IBS-D and other times IBS-C. And then there is the IBS undefined, which means there's really no correlation between the different bowel movements. Most people will fall either in IBS-C or IBS-D. I personally have IBS-M, which means I go through periods of my life with IBS with constipation and then periods of my life with IBS with diarrhea.
That's interesting.
And it goes back and forth.
I know you're a decisive person, so that must make life even more challenging when you have something that is indecisive going back and forth from constipated to diarrhea. Now, it is considered a functional disorder, and a lot of people have misconceptions about why it's called functional, because they say, I have irritable bowel, but I can't function. Can you clarify that a little bit?
Sure. So when a illness is considered a functional disorder, whether it be a functional GI disorder or functional respiratory disorder, what that means mainly is, in sort of nuts and bolts, is that it's inorganic, or there's no way to really test and see any physical evidence within the body that there's something wrong. So if you have a colonoscopy and they see ulcers, and they know that you have ulcerative colitis. If they scope you with irritable bowel syndrome, there's nothing there. All of the tests come back negative. So you can have a series of different tests, and the doctor will keep coming back and saying that the tests are negative and everything is quote-unquote fine, when really things are not fine. You are very ill. You are having major symptoms. Your life is on hold, and you have serious amounts of pain. But it's labeled as a functional disorder, and it's considered oftentimes to be a disorder between the brain and the gut. So there's just as many serotonin receptors in the gut as there is in the brain, and there's a huge amount of research going into the connection between the functions of your brain and the functions of your GI tract. And there's much correlation there. So functional GI disorders are believed to be disorders of brain-gut function, which means the brain isn't talking to your gut the way that it should.
So now that the audience is a little bit more enlightened as to the basics of IBS, can you now share some of your personal account of it as to when did you begin to experience symptoms of irritable bowel? And at that time, did you say, gee, is there something going on that I'm really have no clue what it is? Or did you have a suspicion that it may be IBS?
So I first started having GI symptoms in high school, and I really and truly thought that it was normal and never thought to really question it and just sort of lived. And then after college, they began to get a little more severe, and I actually did have a doctor that sort of specifically asked me about my bowel habits, which was unusual for a GI physician, for a general physician. He was just my regular doctor, a primary care. And it was kind of unusual for him to ask me about that. But I said, well, you know, like everyone, sometimes I had urgency to go to the bathroom. And, you know, we had a conversation, and he said, honestly, it sounds like you have irritable bowel syndrome. I went, wow, that's fantastic. Someone knows what's wrong with me. I'm not the only one. This isn't just something I have to live with. But he followed that with, but there's really nothing that you can do about it. And he sent me to a gastroenterologist, but the gastroenterologist said, well, let's do tests to make sure it's irritable bowel syndrome. So I did a whole series of tests. And everything came back negative, and they said, well, you definitely have irritable bowel syndrome. And I said, okay, now what? And the gastroenterologist said, well, there's nothing that you can do about it. So a nice life. And it was devastating to me. I was a single mom and was trying to hold a job, and there was nothing that they could do for me. So I learned to just live with it. And it was one of those things where you go from day to day and you just feel like, well, this is just what my life is going to be like for the rest of my life, and you just have to accept it. And that's what I did for many years.
Wow. What kind of tests did they have you take at that time?
At that time, I had colonoscopy, an upper endoscopy. I had a gallbladder functioning test. I did several blood tests. I think they took just gallons of blood over the course of several months, running many different blood tests. And then also there were some breath tests and things like that. But that was sort of just the standard workup for people with GI issues they didn't understand.
Wow. And I can't even imagine how you were trying to take these tests, hold down a job, experience these symptoms, and have your family. I can't even imagine what you were enduring at that time.
It was very difficult. Yeah.
So you were pretty much left on your own? So were you prescribed anything?
No, there were no prescriptions. And so I was left on my own. I went to many health food stores, supplements. Different people would say, we'll try probiotics, and I did those. I tried many, many different brands, and the ones that are in the refrigerator case, the ones that are on the shelf, the ones at all the different major retailers. I tried different herbal remedies, colon cleanse and colon this, and digestive supplements and peppermint oil and all the different sort of anything that I would read about or someone would tell me about. I would run out and try those things. Some helped a little, nothing helped completely. I looked at modifications for my diet, but, you know, it was just one of those things that I just learned to push through and sort of gave up on trying the different miracle. There wasn't going to be a miracle drug for me, and I just pushed through and learned to sort of cope and feel when my body was giving me some warning of potentially an episode coming up.
Did you find that there were certain foods that instigated it a little bit more than others?
Yes. For me personally, I found that there were certain spicy foods, and I love spicy foods, that would trigger an episode. Some, interestingly, it wasn't all spicy. I think it's just certain peppers maybe that have more of an effect on me than others. So I did find that watching how many times I ate Indian in a week, for example, was important. I also did notice some help when I would make sure I got enough sleep. When I was entirely too stressed out and running on fumes, too much coffee and caffeine, I tended to have more episodes and more frequently during the day as well. So I may have two or three in a day instead of, you know, one. And one is bad enough, so.
Yeah. Are you lactose intolerant?
I am not lactose intolerant, actually. My brother is, and so I did think that maybe I might be, but there was never any correlation between any dairy products and my symptoms.
So what was your diet like then? You just, did you keep a food diary, or did you make eat smaller quantities? How did you manage that?
So just to be very honest, at that point I was a single mom working as a church secretary, and money was very tight. So I ate very little. And when I did, it could be what I could afford at the moment, because times were very tough for my daughter and I, and I wanted her to eat as well as possible. I think I exasperated my symptoms by not being able to eat as healthy as I probably should have. But unfortunately, at that point in time, I was just struggling to pay for all the doctor visits and the tests, keep my child in, you know, daycare, and make sure that, you know, the bills were all paid. So a lot of that sort of trial and error, I had to let something sort of go, and I think that I did less with my diet, and I did try, you know, those sort of supplements, thinking that would be the miracle pill, and I wasn't probably as rigorous on my diet until a little bit later on when I got older and changed jobs and was able to stabilize myself a little bit more financially.
And I'm sure, like so many with irritable bowel as well as other motility disorders, that stress is not the cause of it, but certainly when you're under added stress, it hits you in that gut and it makes things worse.
It does. It is definitely something that increases the intensity, even not just maybe the frequency, which it does. But I find that when I'm really under tremendous amounts of stress, the intensity of my irritable bowel syndrome attacks would be much greater. And yeah. I find them more debilitating. And then you become unable to work. And when you get paid by the hour, you have to work to be able to get money to pay for those doctor bills and to pay for the tests and everything else. And so that stress just continues to just build on itself. And you feel like you're in a hole and you just can't dig out. And you're trying to get control of your life, and it just seems to be spinning out of control, and you have no way to really ground yourself and pull yourself out when you're still spinning.
Isn't it amazing how much, when you look in retrospect, and even now in your life, how much you power through with the symptoms,
yes,
and with the stress? You just go with it now, and that's a very difficult thing to do, very difficult. That's sheer will.
Yes. Well, I was a single mom, and my parents had died when I was younger, so I felt very sort of alone, And I felt like my daughter had to be my number one priority. So just focusing on being the best mom I could be, I had no choice but to power through. I didn't have anyone to fall back on. I didn't have any ability to take a break because I had to push through. And out of that necessity, I learned to do it. And now I am able to push through to be able to do the work that I do now.
And tell me, because I know you had mentioned in this program that you have one daughter. Are any of your family members affected by IBS or other GI conditions?
Yes. I actually have three daughters, three beautiful daughters. My oldest daughter is 20, and she has irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea. And my youngest daughter is 12, and she has chronic constipation and functional abdominal pain syndrome, both. And so I have, two of my three daughters have GI illness as well. So this is very important to me.
Yes, I know that. So in your particular case, it sounds like it's genetic in nature. Is that typically what happens with IBS, or are they finding that sometimes it's just random?
So there's a lot of research that's been done. I think that the likelihood of a child to have IBS that has a parent with IBS tends to be statistically significant. And so that does show some evidence that it may be genetic in nature, although the research still needs to be done to really show if that is true. There are some researchers that are checking, are looking into maybe it's not genetics, but more environmental. So they see families with adopted children or stepchildren that have GI illness, like the step parent or the foster parent, although they are not biologically related. So there could be just a plethora of different causes and reasons. And there's a lot of research that needs to be done in these areas that would help people. But there does seem to be a lot of correlation between the parent-child relationship with irritable bowel syndrome.
And it's not only on one side, like the maternal side or the paternal. It's just random.
Yes. And I think the research isn't very clear as to if there is a direct correlation or if maybe there are other factors that contribute, but there is definitely a pattern of parent and child.
So now you were saying you worked as a church secretary. What other type of jobs did you do?
So I worked as a church secretary when my oldest daughter was very small, and then I moved to a computer software company that wrote software for nonprofit organizations, and I was working in the financial side of that product and worked with this company for several years. It was a very high stress position. It made my symptoms probably exasperatedly worse, but it was a good job, and it really, I worked with many nonprofits and sort of fell in love with the whole nonprofit genre and just wanting to do something in my life that I think helped people. And I was given an opportunity to take a job with the Rome Foundation, which is a physician education group that works in functional GI and motility disorders. I felt a huge synergy with them right away because of my illness, and worked for the Rome Foundation for almost 10 years as their executive director, and ran many projects where we wrote a series of books for physicians, educating them about functional GI disorders, and also many, many educational programs on the web, symposia, things like that, where we just really went out to the physicians to try to teach them more about these diseases so that they could help their patients. I found that extremely rewarding and was very lucky to have that opportunity for so long.
That is amazing. Did they find, and did you find that the physicians were very open to learning about all these things?
Well, I think as a whole, the majority, I think, yes. Now, there were some that, you know, maybe were a little more hesitant to really open up to different disease states. However, I think as a whole, physicians, they want to help their patients. They want to learn. It's just that these disorders are very confusing, not only to us patients who are struggling, but physicians often struggle with the right treatment plan for patients because every patient is unique in their illness experience. So the way I experience irritable bowel syndrome is very different from the way my daughter experiences it. And so you have to really learn a lot. There's so much to learn. And I think physicians get overwhelmed just like patients do, and they're struggling to keep up with the science and to sort of learn all the treatments. But I think a lot of physicians, maybe most of them, are interested in helping their patients, and so they are very open to learning this material.
Yeah, and that's very encouraging. And I know I have found within our organization that when we have, well, in the past we have the symposiums, but even for conferences, the heightened interest for doctors to really learn, and not only the doctors, but other members of the medical community, nurses, they really do care and they do really want to learn and help. So that's excellent. After the Rome Foundation, then what happened?
So while I was working at the Rome Foundation, I was approached by the International Foundation for Functional Gastrointestinal Disorders. That IFFGD is a patient education and advocacy organization that was founded by Nancy and Bill Norton almost 30 years ago. They have always been considered very close to the Rome Foundation, where we work together on many things. IFFGD would do patient work, Rome would do physician work, and then there was a lot of sort of overlap and collaboration between the two organizations. So I've known Bill and Nancy for the 10 years that I worked at Rome, and they approached me last spring about coming on board with IFFGD as they prepared for retirement. And so I was thrilled at the opportunity to begin to work with patients and to help patients the way that I had been working with the physicians. And so I accepted that position and started last July, July 1st of 2017. I started my journey with working with patients. It's been fabulous.
Congratulations on that. Yeah, it's a great opportunity. It's a wonderful organization. As I had said when I had spoken with you one-on-one, that Nancy Norton, I met, and we both started our organizations at about the same time. A very, very intelligent, kind-hearted, wonderful woman. And so that has been my honor to know her. And I see that they have picked some outstanding people to carry the torch that she has left within the organization for all of you. What kind of projects now? What is your role? Can you go into a little more detail about what you do?
Absolutely. So I am the executive director and president of IFFGD, and so I sort of oversee everything that we are doing as an organization. And as an organization, we have some general categories. So first and foremost, the foundation of almost every patient group, as you know, is about community. Because I think that, like myself, so many patients feel that they are alone, that there's no one else. And we want to establish a community and let patients know that they are not alone and that there are resources for connecting with other patients. We also strive to educate, and we educate patients, their caregivers and loved ones. We educate physicians and the media. And we do that through a series of websites that we have. We have 8 websites on different disease states. There's one on irritable bowel syndrome that's called aboutibs.org. And those, the education that we create for those websites and for our patients are written by the actual researchers that are publishing the research in the peer-reviewed journals and are considered the experts in the topic area. So we go actually directly to the source, and we go to them and we ask them if they would be willing to sort of translate some of this material into ways that patients can understand. And these physicians, just to take aside here, they're fabulous. I can't say enough about the researchers in this area because they really do want to do what's best for patients. They love their patients, and they overwhelmingly agree to help us in any way that we can. So we write a lot of articles and have a lot of education on our websites. We do reporter's guides so that the media and the people publishing online can have accurate and factual information to give patients, because there's so much out there. We really want to try to help educate people so that it's correct. And if someone does a Google search, they're getting the right information. And so education is a big push for us. We do as much research as we can. Excuse me. At IFHD, we do have a research program. We award researchers to try to keep research moving, and when funding is available, we conduct our own surveys, mostly on patient illness experience and patient satisfaction, so that we can try to help with our advocacy, which is a very large part of what we do, a presence in Washington, really raising awareness for all of the patients with functional GI disorders and motility disorders, to make sure that all of those people at the NIH and FDA and HHS and the VA and, of course, on the Hill, our congressional leaders, that they know what we're going through, and they know that there are millions of us in the U.S. alone that are suffering from different forms of GI illness, and we stand up and try to raise that awareness so that legislation can be passed for more funding in these areas, and so that we can speak on behalf of the patients that may or may not be able to travel to Washington on their own.
Wow. So you serve, in a sense, as the voice, correct?
Yes, ma'am. Absolutely. We want to be the voice of the patient and to make sure that we are giving a true voice of the patient, and that we are doing it in the right ways, in the right places, so that we can affect the most change.
And there is a bill that is up, correct?
Yes.
So can you talk a little more about that?
Absolutely. So IFFGD has initiated legislation. It is budget neutral piece of legislation. It's called the Functional Gastrointestinal and Motility Disorders Research Enhancement Act. It's currently in the House of Representatives as H.R. 1187. And what this does is it calls for more awareness, more research, and more funding for functional GI and motility disorders, and that it calls sort of to the NIH to increase the allotment of funds that they give and to allow them the ability to spend the dollars in the functional GI motility space and to help increase the research being done in this area.
So how can people, the listeners in the audience who may not be able to even be here today, how can they get involved with that?
So it's very easy. You can call your member of Congress and tell them that you support H.R. 1187 and that you ask that they do as well, and ask them to sign on as a co-sponsor for this piece of legislation. You can email them and let them know this. And you can contact IFFGD for more information on how to do that. Our email address is actually ifffgd@iffgd.org. And we can actually give you some language, give you tips on what to say, help you with your message, and give you more information. We are also able to connect you directly with your senator or congressman so that you know exactly where to go.
Right. So you're making it a lot easier for patients and family members to become
Absolutely.
That advocate. And, you know, a lot of people always
Absolutely.
Say, well, what can I do? I'm sick. Mm-hmm. What can I do? You know, I'm just one little person. But you can definitely make a difference. Every small step is a huge step in the scope of this
Absolutely.
Area.
Absolutely. And then, you know, talking about it with your loved ones and your community and asking them to also make that call and becoming a spokesperson for HR 1187, so to speak, where you just talk to your neighbors and your friends and your coworkers and say, hey, would you mind shooting an email to your senator? Would you mind calling this phone number and calling them and talking to them about it? Because every single person that calls is one more voice in the collective, and that makes it a larger presence for us in Washington.
Yeah, very well said. Now, can you focus a little bit on progress that's being made, both in the diagnosis, the treatment, and any research that may be in the pipeline?
So I think there's a lot of fascinating research that's going on right now. Some of the most groundbreaking work is being done in the microbiome. So Emron Myers Research Group out of UCLA is doing some fantastic things. They have a center of excellence there, and he has really beginning to show how your microbiome really is sort of determining your gut function. But more than that, even how your microbiome can affect your stress levels and your daily body function and everything about you. And so I think that as time continues to move forward, I think that we will find that this research is really going to help us figure out how our bowel movements can be sort of brought back to the norm, back to the middle, back to where they need to be, by looking at ways to correct your gut microbiome. So there's some really fantastic things that are going on in that area for irritable bowel syndrome specifically, and I think that that's very exciting for us as patients to see that. There are also some great companies out there that are doing research in irritable bowel syndrome, and so we've got more therapies on the market. You know, when I was first diagnosed in my 20s, there were no medications that I could take for my constipation or my diarrhea or my IBS. Now there are. And so I think that's very, very, it gives a lot of hope to me for the future, and knowing that there are even more in the pipeline that are in the basic science stage and the just, you know, clinical trials in the first phase of that. But they're coming, and they're researching those. So one day, hopefully, there will be medication for each one of us, no matter what our severity is or what our subtype is, that there will be a range of medications, and we will all be able to benefit from at least one of them.
Yeah. Now, how is IBS typically diagnosed nowadays?
So there are sort of two rules of thought on that. One is the diagnosis of exclusion, and that has the patient do a tremendous amount of tests. And each of these tests coming up negative gives you the conclusion that it must be IBS. I don't think that's considered the gold standard any longer. The Rome Foundation has a set of symptom-based criteria that if you meet Rome criteria, then you could be diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome. Of course, making sure that you're looking at all of the red flags and ensuring that you don't have anything else because, for example, if there's been rapid weight loss in recent months, then that would be an indication that maybe it's not just IBS, maybe it's IBS and something else, or maybe it's just something else. And so I think that, you know, your doctor is the best person to talk to and to work with on that. But there is the Rome 4 criteria for irritable bowel syndrome, which is relatively new. It was published 2016.
I see. What about the IBS blood test? Have you heard anything on that?
Absolutely. So there are several new tests. There are blood tests that are available, and then there's some breath tests that help diagnose as well. Those have all had really great results in their testing and the research done on those. And so I think that they can be very, very helpful for patients in diagnosis of IBS. They're not available everywhere, I don't think, but it's fantastic the way the field and the research is moving to where there are opportunities for tests to be able to make it easier for the diagnosis.
Yes, and I'm wondering if insurance covers those.
I don't believe it does in all cases, although I know that the companies that I have spoken with are working diligently to get coverage for patients. Many of them have programs, and if patients can talk to their physicians and then also do some research online, many of them, if they're not covered by insurance, do have some patient programs that might be available to them. So definitely don't not do something. At least do some research to see if it might be possible to still be able to do it if money is an issue. And with so many of us with IBS, we spend so much money on our disease. It's it's estimated that IBS patients spend over $10,000 a year just on their disease, and that's sort of the cost of living with IBS. And that's a lot. So for those of us that do have those issues, there are often some patient help programs through these companies, or sometimes your physician might be able to write a letter to your insurance company. So definitely do what you have to and see if you can find help.
Yes, and I know a lot of patients that get so discouraged when they get a rejection from the insurance company, but you got to keep on trying because there are ways. It's persistence.
Right. Absolutely. And these companies, I work with them quite often. I have lots of meetings with them and talk to them, and they are really in the right place, I'm happy to say. They really are doing this for the patients. Many of these people that I speak with have family members or friends with IBS, and so their whole motivation is to bring these tests, these therapies, these diagnoses and treatments to patients to help them. And so sometimes just reaching out to the company and saying, hey, is there any way you can help me? I really need your test, but my insurance doesn't cover it. There may be things that can be done.
Great advice. Now, in your own life, what have you found to be the most challenging symptom? If you had to pick.
That's so tough. So, I have the top two. And to be honest, I think the most challenging symptom for me is the exhaustion following an episode. So there's severe pain, and then afterwards, you just want to lay in bed and curl up in a ball, and your entire body feels completely drained after an episode of IBS. And for me, sometimes that's the worst because it's hard to get back up and get moving again, to start the fight again, to try to get back to work, when you just feel exhausted.
And you said it was between two. What was your other one?
The other one would be probably the pain, especially for single moms when you have to work and you're in pain, and sometimes I might be in a meeting and you're trying to pay attention, but you're in so much pain. Or I am trying to have a conversation with someone on the phone, And then the pain hits, and then having to try to speak and function through the pain is very difficult.
Do you experience brain fog as well?
Yes, I do. With very severe episodes of IBS, I do tend to feel disoriented and in sort of in a fog where you just, it's hard to focus and concentrate. And, of course, that makes it difficult when you're a parent and you're trying to keep up with your children's schedule, your schedule, work, and everything else. And you forget things and you miss stuff. And it happens, and it's okay.
What about, how do you even prepare and do all the traveling that you do?
So for me, I do travel a lot with IFFGD, more than I originally thought I would, but it's all good things, and we're making progress in the field, and so I'm happy to do it. Probably the biggest thing for me is making sure that I have time, that I don't cut my connections close, that I give myself plenty of time to get from the airport to the hotel, plenty of time to get to a meeting, which alleviates the stress level in my life, but also gives me some leeway so that if I do have an episode, I am able to handle that without missing a meeting. And to make sure that I just really and truly never push myself to being rushed when I travel. That's important for me.
Have you had to deal with time changes?
Yes, I have traveled overseas extensively with the Rome Foundation, and that is always difficult. That is extremely difficult, especially with your bowels, because if your gut starts, you know, processing foods at different times of the day, and then your schedule is out of whack and you're sleeping when you normally wouldn't be sleeping, it does tend to, it's everything can be a little bit off-centered in your life. Having irritable bowel syndrome on top of that is very difficult.
Yes. So I know a lot of patients, they struggle with that social aspect too. Going out to eat, family restaurant, you know, family going out to eat or special function. And
right.
That can be very hard, not only physically on the patient, but mentally. How have you learned to adapt?
So for me, sometimes it's to just not eat at the function. A lot of times it can be, I had a really late lunch today. Let me just get something to drink. I just want to hang out with you guys. Or saying, I'm not very hungry. I'm going to order something to go and eat it later. Many people won't pry too much into that sort of thing, but kind of go, oh, okay, and then they keep going. There's normally not a focus. If you just sort of play it down and still be able to enjoy the social aspects without having to put yourself at risk of having to run to the bathroom during the middle of a meal, which can be just absolutely mortifying. For our family, it's interesting you talk about restaurants. With my daughter, when she was in elementary school and had one of her very first episodes of IBS, it was coming home from a restaurant. And we were in the car, and she was in so much pain, and she was just didn't know what was going on with her body. And we ended up having to pull over to get her to a bathroom very quickly. And from that moment on, she's refused to eat at that restaurant. And so for 10, 15 years, our family knows that if she is joining us for dinner, we will not go there. And so I think for some people, avoidance of certain types of foods that may cause triggers for them, then restaurant avoidance, food cuisine avoidance is very helpful. And a lot of times if you are in a group, you can just say, you know, guys, I just had Mexican yesterday. Can we not do that today? And, or, you know, I'm really not feeling steak. And people will take your thoughts into consideration in making the plans. So that makes it easy when you're doing things with people that maybe you don't feel comfortable enough to really say, you know, I've got a GI illness, and it really limits what I'm able to eat or how much I'm able to eat. And obviously, if you feel comfortable with the person, then be honest and let them know, I have an illness, and my illness requires me to have certain restrictions to my diet or my life. And do you mind if, you know, maybe we don't go to the movie right after dinner? Can we do the movie first and then have dinner afterwards? Because for me, I'll be under less stress if we watch the movie first and then go get something to eat. Then if I have to run out, I can go home. So if you have comfort level with the people, then let them know and bring that awareness into the community that this happens and that there are millions, tens of millions of people in the U.S. alone with irritable bowel syndrome. So you're not alone. And being open and honest about it can really, really be helpful.
I think, too, more so maybe nowadays, there are so many restaurants that have specialized diets. You have the celiac is an example of that. So sometimes even talking to a chef or the person who is taking your order and reminding them of your restrictions can really help as well.
Absolutely. I think that people are more aware of food intolerances, and food intolerances do play a really large role in irritable bowel syndrome, and that there are a lot of patients that food elimination does help with their symptoms. And when you go to a restaurant and you say, I cannot eat eggs, or I cannot have dairy, I can't have wheat, the restaurateurs are very, very open to wanting to be accommodating to that. And I've actually been out with friends who are on special dietary restriction, and a chef might even come out and say, okay, so I understand you can't have X, Y, and Z, but you can have this. I'm going to create a special dish just for you. And they create something on the fly, and it's always fabulous. And it's really great. And I like to always express my thanks when I see these restaurants and really let them know they're above and beyond. It's appreciated by all of us with GI illness. Even if we don't have as many dietary restrictions, I appreciate the fact that they're willing to do that for all of us.
Yes. I just want to remind the audience that in a little while, we're going to open up the lines for anybody who has a comment, wants to share their experience, or ask Cecile a question. So if you're listening in, just know that that opportunity will be coming shortly. Now, what have you learned about yourself in dealing with this chronic IBS?
So probably the biggest thing that I learned about myself is I'm willing to put up with a whole lot more for myself than I am for my children. Because it wasn't until my daughter started showing symptoms of IBS that I really got serious about really learning more about the illness and getting more aggressive with doctors about getting a diagnosis and really more proactive about the lifestyle choices of the family to make her life better. And I think that that is not always a great thing, because we should be taking care of ourselves. And it wasn't until my daughter started suffering that I really took and got control of my own irritable bowel syndrome. And so I think that's the one thing that I sort of learned that wasn't a good thing, because we need to take care of ourselves and take care of our bodies. And I wasn't doing that until it affected someone I cared about.
It's an excellent answer. And then capitalizing on that just a little bit more, how has living with IBS from the beginnings to now, how has it changed you as a person, if it has?
Absolutely. I think that when you suffer with a chronic illness, it makes you more understanding of others with chronic illness. Even if they don't have a GI disorder or they don't have irritable bowel syndrome, I am much more empathetic, much more open. I want to hear from them. And when they want to discuss their illness and talk about their struggles, I can relate. It may not be the same, but I can relate. I have a dear friend who has been diagnosed with dystonia, which is a very different disorder, but a chronic disorder. And even though they're different, we can relate to one another. And when she was struggling with finding a diagnosis, and it took her years, I found myself to be extremely patient and supportive during that time where I think, you know, I don't know, things, if I was 15, things were different, maybe not, but I really do feel that some of that was due to having gone through it myself. I've been through this, and I want to help others get through it as well.
Yeah, I think we all have those common threads, maybe different diseases, but we've all shared similar journeys in a sense. And, you know, it's certainly not what you would have signed up for, but seeing though you did, you're doing great work as a result of that. Now, on the internet, and you touched upon this a little bit, there are so many myths about IBS. And every time you just Google IBS, you get a wealth of information. How can people discern truth from fact? That's number one. And number two is, what are some of those myths, the real stigmas and myths that are out there?
So I think that we'll start with stigmas. So I think one of the things that IFFDD is really trying to do is sort of break through the stigmas. And I think the largest one is IBS is a dirty disease. It's not. It's not. You have urgency to go to the restroom. Yes, you've got pain in your abdomen that's associated with the bowel movement. Absolutely. But it's nothing to be ashamed of. It's no less important than someone who is having bouts of diarrhea due to their Crohn's disease. You know, same symptom, but for some reason, IBS is looked upon differently. And I think that that has to start with us as patients and loved ones of patients and physicians and saying, no, it's not. And it's almost the norm with as many people as have it. And so one of the second things is that it's an alienating disease. It's something where patients feel that it's just me. I have to live with this. I've got to stay home, and I can never go out because I have IBS, and people will never understand, so I have to keep this to myself, and people will judge me. And so it's very alienating. People self-alienate themselves because of their disease, and I think that with the progress of research, what we're learning in the field, the therapies that are available today, I think that patients need to stand up for that, and they need to say, hey, let me live again. Let me get my life back and control the disease instead of the disease controlling me. So I think those are probably the two largest stigmas in things that happen with patients. That people need to get past. The education piece, Mary Angela, is very difficult because there's a lot about irritable bowel syndrome on the internet, and so much of it is not true. There are people that are trying to give the right information, but they're sort of misleading in how they might do that. A lot of that around foods. And one of the largest and most dangerous things out there now is some of the material that are being written about FODMAP diets.
Yeah.
Because food plays such an integral role with irritable bowel syndrome and most GI illnesses, actually. I mean, what you eat, right, is very important to your lifestyle and your health. But the FODMAP diet, while it is a wonderful tool for the dietitian and physician to use, to help you distinguish what foods you might not be able to tolerate and what might be exacerbating your IBS symptoms and how to get those under control. It is a tool, and it is not really a diet. It's not something that patients can start and say, I'm on FODMAP diet, and do that for the rest of their lives. That's extremely unhealthy, and it's not the reason that the FODMAP diet was developed. It was developed as a way to eliminate foods from your diet and scientifically and systematically reintroduce them back into your diet so that you can know what are causing the symptoms that you're having. And then modifying your diet to exclude those items, but still eating very well-rounded, nutritionally whole meals so that you're not lacking in any of the vitamins, minerals, and food groups that you need.
Working with a dietitian is paramount to ensure that. And everything is so individual. Again, there's no cookie-cutter solution for patients. What works for one may not work for another. So it's important that you go to the right place to get the right expert. I know a lot of patients, they buy books, and they read within those books, and then that's their gospel. That's what they follow. And then they find, oh, yeah, this worked, and then it doesn't work. Or it works, and then they start espousing that to other patients.
Right.
So,
and a lot or of, it's not nutritionally complete, and it works, but it causes other side effects or problems down the road.
Right.
So, working with a dietitian
is
very, very important.
Right. But you have to take into account, too, if you have secondary diseases. And then if you're a diabetic, you have IBS, you know, that's going to have a big consequential effect on all of this. So working with your doctor, working with a dietitian. So those are critical. I know that a lot of patients get their, and family members get their information from the internet, and they're getting a lot of it through blogs and communities that are online that are patients saying, well, this is my experience. This is what I did. And, oh, it's the most horrible disease. And then they start potentially instilling fear in patients. So
yes,
how do patients really... No, go ahead, Cecile.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. With your question.
I was just going to say, in just enhancing, how do patients discern? What should they be reading to get their education? What resources should they be going to? And
so,
to really take into account when they're looking at these patient sites, to be able to evaluate for themselves.
Right.
Go ahead, Cecile.
So okay. So there are many, many, I mean, there's so many places that you can go for information about different disease states and especially irritable bowel syndrome. I think that there's two issues. One, getting correct information, and IFFCD does have a suite of websites that has a lot of really great information out there. There are other places that you can go, the NIH, NIDDK. Government agencies have wonderfully sound scientific information for patients on their website. But one of the things that I like to do when I'm doing sort of the research is to sort of look at the website, and generally, and this is just not a scientific approach, but generally, if you're looking at something that is from a registered nonprofit organization, then you may likely have more success and quality information rather than some place that's trying to sell you something. So if you go to a website and they sell a specific tea or a certain gummy that you can take for IBS, And then the material that they have are only going to be the one side that says that you should buy their product. So maybe going to something that's not looking to promote any specific thing is very helpful. But doing some cross-referencing, you could look at that information and then take it to your doctor and talk to your physician about it and find out, is it scientifically accurate and valid, is probably the best approach, or your nurse practitioner or your physician assistant. I mean, all of those medical providers would be able to go through some of the things that you read to discern fact from fiction on the internet.
And
with the blog post.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I was just
No, go ahead. Finish off, because I was going to deviate from that for a bit.
Okay. Well, I think it's very important for patients to share their stories. And it's for some reason, I think that it's also good for people to read those stories and to see how it does affect different people. And one of the things that I say often is, if you give me 100 patients with irritable bowel syndrome, I can show you 100 different diseases, basically, in the way that they present themselves. And there will be 100 different treatments for each of those patients, because everyone's IBS is a little bit different and everyone's story is a little bit different. And I think that reading those for understanding of what other people might be going through is a good thing. But not reading it to say, well, if my IBS doesn't match this other person's perfectly, then one of us doesn't have IBS. That's not true. And just because one person may have a super severe case doesn't mean that you will. And if you don't have a super severe case now, it doesn't mean it won't develop to that. And taking care of yourself and your body is important. But,
perfectly articulated, Cecile. Perfectly articulated. Can you focus a little bit, if you have knowledge of it, but I know a lot of patients turn to alternative therapies. Are there any alternative therapies, like acupuncture or others, that they are finding in clinical studies that are helpful?
So there's a lot of research in that area currently underway right now, and we're all ready to have the results of that for sure. I think probably the most successful research I've seen in an alternative therapy is with hypnosis. So there is a very, very regimented protocol for hypnosis for people with IBS that has been proven extremely effective. And not only is it effective today, it's also proven to be effective in the long term. So patients often will say, I tried this, it worked for a while, but then it stopped. Patients with the hypnosis, when they come back to them many years later, they're still doing well. So I think that there's a lot of hope with this particular alternative therapy, and it's something that patients may want to look into. There is, it's like I said, it's a very strict, regimented therapy that was developed by Ole Paulson, who is at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, in their Center for Functional GI Motility Disorders. And there's a list of trained therapists who have been trained with this protocol, and it is available online, and you can find someone who can do this, hopefully in your area. If you need help finding that research, that resource, reach out to IFFGD, and we can help you with that as well. But I think that that's probably the most exciting thing that I've seen, and the data is very solid for the hypnosis. I think that that's very, very promising for the future. But the acupuncture, the preliminary findings that I've read about have been very good. And, with all therapies, nothing works in everyone, but they work with many. So I think that there's a lot that's being done in that area, and I really look forward to seeing what the future lies for us ahead in that.
Yes. And the only the warning that I give all the patients and family is when you're looking into alternative or holistic type of therapies, always look for the clinical data, because there are so many companies out there that are trying to entice their business patients,
right,
vulnerable patients, to purchase their products with this idea, panacea, that it's going to be the cure-all. There are no cures, at least at this point,
right,
but always ask for that clinical data as that radar in your head going, yes, this is certainly valid. It's a valid type of a treatment to take.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. Yes.
No, I was agreeing with you. I think that's absolutely true, and I think that patients should, you know, with money being tight for all of us, everyone obviously has a budget, you know, that you're really looking at the proven results of things that you're doing. And if you have any questions, IFFGD is to consider us a resource. Feel free to email us, and we can we probably have an article about it, so we can sort of try to help direct you. And, you know, talking even with the hypnosis, there, you know, the one researched and scientifically proven protocol for hypnosis is very, very, very specific. And going to anyone and saying, can you use hypnosis to cure my IBS, is not the right approach. But making sure that you have someone trained to do that clinically accurately according to the protocol. So do your research, yes, and do your homework. That's always, always important.
Excellent. And I know to further add to that, if you are thinking of embracing some sort of a holistic or alternative therapy, and the company does present data, look at how big the study was. Was it 2 patients? Was it, you know, male versus female? So you really have to look at all aspects of that study. Was it just you know, a very restricted study, or was it widespread? Were they control patients, or were they all patients who, you know, did they have some that were normal in there in order to get the data? And so all of the, and also sponsors, the clinical research, all of those are important factors in trying to see if it's the right route to go for you as an individual. Now, I know a lot of patients, they have trouble talking to their doctor. First of all, talking about GI symptoms is very embarrassing, and it can be extremely difficult for many patients. And then you have some doctors who still have preconceived, old-fashioned ideas about IBS, because it used to be the catch-all. When you have this, is what you have. You know, when you have this symptom, you know, you're a woman, you're a young woman, this is what you have. And so a lot of patients have difficulty communicating and trying to describe what they're going through with IBS. Do you have any suggestions for patients on how to talk to their physicians?
You know, absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that's really important is I found personally that it's very rare that I walk into the doctor's office in a full-out mid-IBS episode. And so when you sit there, and it's sort of an embarrassing conversation to have to begin with, and you're trying to recollect back and describe how you felt at that moment, I think it's important for IBS sufferers to write it down. Write it down right afterwards. Ask someone who was there with you. You know, when I was going through that period and the pain, how would you describe that? How would you describe the way I looked, the way I seemed to feel? And write those things down so that when you go to talk to your doctor, you can pull out your piece of paper and say, here is how I felt. This is the exact location of my pain. And you're not having to use recall to remember what your episodes are like, but that you actually have it written down in front of you. It's easier to read it from a piece of paper than to try to remember it, especially when it's something that may be difficult to talk about.
Great suggestion. I also say that if you really think about your appointment, because the doctor only has so much time with the patients, formulate some of the questions beforehand and, again, write them down. And don't hesitate to write down answers during the appointment. And if you don't understand what the doctor is saying, then ask that doctor to repeat it to you in a different way. And if you're still having trouble grasping, what I always say is it my understanding that this is what you're saying? And I say it in my own words to see if I really am getting what they're trying to tell me. So how do you stay so passionate and driven at your work and what you do?
Well, it's very personal to me. I have two daughters with GI illness, and I want to ensure that the future is going to be bright for them, that they're not going to be in their 40s with children and a job trying to make the best of it, but that 20 years from now, life is going to be different for them, that they will be so much further in the research and understanding the causes of these GI illnesses to be able to treat them more effectively and live fuller lives than I had. When I was in my 20s, which should have been a wonderful, energetic, and youthful time, I was worried about how far I was away from a bathroom. I would make plans. I missed a friend's baby shower when I was one of the planning hosts. I couldn't even go because I had an episode of IBS. And I think that I don't want these things for my children. I don't want these things for my children's friends. I don't want to have girls 20 years from now playing sports like my daughter did and having episodes right before a major tournament. And mothers like me on the phone with them, listening to their children cry and bawl their eyes out. And I don't want that for our future. I don't want that for the next generation. I want to make a difference. And the fact that I meet with doctors that are working so hard for these changes inspires me. I meet with companies that are developing the tests and the therapies and the treatments, and they're really energetic about wanting to help the patient, asking me about patient perspective and patient illness experience because they care. That inspires me. And just knowing that we're not alone, that there are groups like yours, like Amjad, that we're all out there for the patient, and we are all trying to raise awareness, education level, and help patients, that inspires me, and it helps me to keep going, knowing that hopefully I'm making a difference, and one day it's going to be so different for patients with functional GI motility disorders, so different.
You can, your voice has changed when you're talked about how you're so passionate about it. You became far more animated. You can tell how that's so close to your heart.
It's so important to me. It's, you know, I have children. I don't want my grandchildren to suffer from this. Like you said, there's very likely a genetic component here. And it's about, okay, my 20s are gone, but my children and my grandchildren, they're going to have a better life.
Well, now, what advice would you give family members who are trying to understand what that patient is going through? And sometimes they have a difficult time when you're a spouse and you're home and you see your either other your partner and has it to the bathroom or not wanting to go places or just staying in bed because of the pain. Or you have siblings who are just losing their patience and they want the attention. So there's a battle where you're giving you know, my brother more attention than you're giving me because my brother is sick. Or, you know, just families trying to come together and support that patient. What advice would you give them?
I think that, you know, they should really step back. So I would want those family members to close their eyes and to picture themselves heading on to work. And that instead of a mocha coffee that morning, there was some sort of laxative put into that cup. And then all day long, they are trying to work and fearful of when they're going to have to run to the bathroom. And imagine how that would feel if all day, every day of your life, you have to be fearful of having an episode. And then think about that and try to understand that the person that they love has to deal with that stress and that fear on a daily basis. And try to put themselves in their place and wonder, how would you cope and what would you do? And sometimes having open conversations with your loved ones about their illness experience and allowing them to talk about it. And then you can work together. I know in my family, we have open conversations about digestive health. And it's okay for us to talk about our bowel movements. We need to make plans for events and what would happen if and what when do you do what. And we talk about these things together. And we have strategies for overcoming the barriers that the illness presents to us. So I think for family members, caregivers, loved ones, siblings, if you just close your eyes for a moment and picture what life is like on the other end, then maybe stopping and having that conversation so that they know it's okay to talk about your illness with me, that alleviates so much stress for people. And then making plans together on how we're a team, husband and wife, we're a team, parent, child, we're a team, brother, sister, we're a team. We're going to battle this illness together. So, you know, I'm on your side and I've got your back. And then it's a different experience for the whole family.
Yeah, that communication is key. And it's always humors me that every human being has a digestive tract and goes to the bathroom one way or another, and yet about so many other things in public, but that's so hushed up. And when you're a baby, it's brought up, and then you're toddler, you know, we potty train, but once you cross that threshold, it becomes a secret. So letting that information out by communicating is huge. Absolutely huge. Cecile, are you okay with me opening up the line now to see if anybody who wants to talk?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's see if we have any talkers out there. Is there anybody who has a question for Cecile or would like to talk about their experiences or has any suggestion or advice for sufferers? Anybody, the line
Hi.
Is open, so if you'd like. Yeah.
Carolyn. Hi, it's Cheryl Ann.
Hi.
Cheryl
Ann, hi. Good.
I wanted to ask.
You're on the air.
Okay, great. I'd love to ask you, you said one of your children has constipation problems?
Yes, ma'am. She does. She was
okay.
Born with it, actually.
How long does she go before she actually can have a bowel movement on her own?
So it varies through the years. So she's 12 now. When she was an infant, she had maybe one bowel movement a week, and it was very hard, painful bowel
wow.
movement. And she was having about one a week, it was terrifying for me as a mother. I actually had to pay, the physician actually told me that it was impossible for her to be constipated because I was breastfeeding. I had to find a new doctor because that's not true. It's absolutely not true. And so I think that as she has gotten older, we don't talk about it until she has reached a couple days without a bowel movement, and then we sort of have that conversation. And then when she goes through periods where it's more significant, where she's having more issues with constipation, and that tends to happen around times when she's eating differently, then we try to have that conversation like every day, like, oh, did you poop today? Did you go to the bathroom today? And we have that conversation sort of running and going, and she is more often now having at least every other day she's able to have a bowel movement.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Anybody else would like to jump in and talk about their experience or ask Cecile a question?
Hi, yes, this is Ishanya.
Hi, welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Hi, I just wanted to share a little bit. I developed cyclic vomiting, and I heard you mention that, and then, of course, I got a phone call, and I missed it all of what was said about that. But I actually have a couple questions. Like I said, I developed cyclic vomiting upon pregnancy, and then shortly after, within a couple of years, I developed diarrhea IBS. Trying to seek attention, medical help, treatment, whatever, anybody to listen to me alone about the CVS alone was just, it's still limiting. There's nothing out there for me where I'm at locally. Anyway, the doctor didn't seem concerned until I started mentioning the diarrhea happening. And then, of course, it was all blamed on IBS, and that was my problem, and it was causing me to vomit. So I was wondering, is there research being done statistically of the more rare GI disorders that go hand-in-hand with IBS, or do they go hand-in-hand with IBS? I also have gastroparesis now. And I see, I don't know if it's evolving or if it just, you know, there's just not enough information out there for me to understand exactly what's going on, but I know IBS, my cyclic vomiting, and now the gastroparesis, it's all led into each other. So my question was, is there research being done for the IBS that's running with more with the rare GI disorders, because there is things being done about the gut brain now.
Yeah. So there's research in many different aspects of irritable bowel syndrome. Definitely not enough, honestly. And a lot of that is what IFFGD does so much for advocating for, is to get more research dollars to talk, to learn more about these overlapping conditions. So we have found a significant overlap between IBS and chronic fatigue as well, you know, some that not even a GI disorder. And how do we understand that pathophysiology? I actually have functional dyspepsia as well as irritable bowel syndrome, and that is another overlap. And I don't think that there's not a large study being done on that currently, but I know that there are a lot of researchers that treat patients with multiple functional GI conditions, and I would probably, you know, recommend that patients that feel like they have overlapping and multiple functional GI disorders find a tertiary care center that may specialize in that. I know that the University of Michigan has a great program. UCLA has a wonderful program. And there are several others in the U.S., great physicians all over the U.S. that I know personally who treat patients for each of those. So if you have them overlapping, they probably are likely more able to target your treatment collectively.
Okay. And you guys also touched on explaining to the doctor about the symptoms of IBS. And how can we explain or articulate to a doctor that, yes, we do have IBS, but we also think there's more going on?
So I think just being very clear, and I think that, you know, what you just said is fine. You know, doctor, I understand I have irritable bowel syndrome. However, how can I be assured as a patient that there's nothing else? What other possibilities are there that it could be, and what have we done to rule out those options? There's a lot of studies being done now, for example, with IBS-D patients, that they may have a sucrase isomaltate intolerance, which is causing the symptoms, or a bile acid malabsorption issue. There are other conditions that may overlap, and your doctor can test for those if you feel that is something that you want to do.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions for Cecile? No. So we only have 2 minutes left. Cecile, what closing words of wisdom can you give everybody about living with IBS?
I don't know that my words are very wise, but I will say that, number one, you're not alone. There are so many of us that suffer from irritable bowel syndrome, as well as many other conditions that affect your GI tract, that there are resources available to you at ISFGD, and if they aren't there and they're needed, then we will work to provide them. We have a patient panel so that your voice can be heard by our organization. Feel free to contact us anytime at ISFGD@ISFGD.org with questions, comments, stories, and let us hear from you and know that you're not alone and that we are going to do this together.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Cecile, I cannot thank you and the ISFGD enough for, first of all, the ISFGD for partnering with us so that we were able to do this program. This being April is IBS Awareness Month. And to thank you, Cecile, for all your excellent information, both personal and professional. And thank you for everything that you do. And we thank our audience as well for coming to our program and for the great questions that were asked for Cecile. Thank you again, and we hope to see you or hear our radio program
so much.
Next month. Take care. God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Cecile.
Thank you.
10.
10.
10. It's more than just a number. It's a measure of success. It's validation for a job well done.
10.
10. It's a symbol of perfection.
10 is something we all strive for.
And 10 means a promise to put you first.
Because your weather,
your mornings, your stories
are our passion.
NBC 10 Boston. Boston's 10.
Support for the podcast and the following message come from Arts Emerson presenting Hamnet. Shakespeare's only son takes center stage in tour de force performances. From a child's perspective, September 20th through October 7th at the Emerson Paramount Center. Tickets at artsemerson.org.